I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about gnocchi, traveling dinner parties, and spring peas. But first, and even before we compare notes on something we read this week, let's talk a little bit about something that happened to Joy and me recently. So this podcast was nominated for an award by the Rad Girls. I guess maybe a month or so ago we heard about it.
The Rad Girls are a group in Philadelphia who try to spotlight women doing cool things and leadership things and tech things. So we were really excited when they chose us to be among the nominees for their annual Storyteller Awards.
And the ceremony was a few weeks ago, and Joy and I went thinking, there's no way we're going to win. We don't win things. And we were standing in the very back of the room when they announced the winner, and lo and behold, it was us. And so we were really delighted, and so we just wanted to give a little shout out to the Rad Girls and say thank you for giving us your award. We are touched and honored beyond belief.
Yeah, and if you live in Philadelphia and are interested in women doing cool things, you should Google Rad Girls, and you'll see they have a whole, I think now 2 years worth of nominees and winners in all kinds of interesting categories if you just want to learn more about women doing cool things in Philly, which is one of our favorite topics.
Absolutely. So thanks, Rad Girls. We really appreciate it.
Congratulations, Marisa.
Congratulations, Joy. It's really fun to win something.
It is. We like.
But enough about our grand award. Let's talk a little bit about the study that was in the New York Times recently about the results from all of this research about The Biggest Loser and how people who have been on that show, it seems that their metabolisms never recover. And so their bodies are always going to want to regain all that weight that they lost.
Right. Well, what they did is they followed the winners from, I believe, season 9 for 7 years. And as it turned out, all but one of them ended up regaining the weight that they had lost. And while all of the individual people and, you know, anyone who has ever lost weight and gained it back did, they just blamed themselves for you know, not being able to stick with the program or whatever, but they had their, you know, metabolisms tested, and it turned out that they were all burning significantly fewer calories than other people of their same weight because of the damage that extreme dieting, or really probably any dieting and weight loss brings to your, you know, physiological function. You know, you just don't metabolize. Your metabolism just doesn't work the way that it's supposed to at that point. And the scientists said that they expected this result in the short term, but they thought they would rebound. And the fact is, like, even all these years later, their metabolisms have not rebounded, and it makes it almost impossible to lose or maintain a weight loss.
Yeah, it's sort of a little bit daunting, but also makes you think it's just time to embrace who we are as we are. And not try to screw around with our bodies and metabolisms any more than we already have over the years.
Right. Well, I really think the bedrock message in this study, which is something that I think a lot of people have been saying for years, is that, you know, no one would ever say, just forget about it, eat whatever you want, like give up on your health. But I think that the focus really should be on health outcomes and behaviors, not what your body weighs. Because in many cases, particularly when you look at The Biggest Loser, where people show up weighing sometimes like 300 odd pounds, you know, it's not really realistic that those people are going to lose 200, you know, 150 pounds and like keep it off for life. That's not helpful. I mean, it would make a very boring TV show, but it would be much more helpful to get these people and actually everybody, you know, to eat more vegetables and be more active. Yeah. Like, it's so unsexy, but like, that's where the health improvement is.
It's so true. It was really fascinating. If you haven't read it, make sure to go.
We'll definitely link to it in the show notes. And I just think that dieting is so destructive. And I've personally done so much of it. And I just think that we're really on the cusp of seeing it for the health hazard that it is. And, the focus really should be on nutrition, not calorie restriction.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll get there.
Fingers crossed. So from The Biggest Loser to what's for dinner? Joy, what is for dinner this week?
Well, it just so happens this week I'm eating quite a bit of gnocchi. It's kind of unusual for me. It's not like a regular staple in my house. But we just put on Mother's Day dinner for my mom and Dan's mom. And we had seen this recipe on our favorite cooking show, America's Test Kitchen, for Roman-style semolina gnocchi, which is something that I've had at restaurants before. I had a delicious version at Osteria on Mark Vetri's restaurant on North Broad Street, and it looked relatively simple. So we were like, it was make ahead, you know? Mm-hmm. So we tried it, and it was just terrific. And I'm definitely going to be making that again sometime soon. But later in the week, we have something somewhat less homemade planned, which we're going to have, you know, the packaged potato gnocchi with, it's a recipe from the kitchen. It's a chicken and fennel ragu.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty good.
Sounds really good.
So that's a lot of gnocchi for me for it one is. Week.
I haven't tried to make gnocchi in years now. I remember back in the days when I was writing for Slash Food and trying to come up with interesting recipes, I made a sweet potato gnocchi. And it was good. It was not my best work, but I feel like to do gnocchi right, you really have to practice. It's sort of something you develop a sort of feel for, and I just didn't have the practice.
I think potato gnocchi are the hardest kind to make.
Yeah.
I think the potatoes have to have a certain moisture level. You definitely want to use russet potatoes, and you have to have the experience to know, you know, because I think you have to adjust the ratios of stuff in it on the fly to get the exact right texture. I haven't had a lot of luck with potato gnocchi from scratch either. But you know what is delightful to make from scratch?
What?
Ricotta gnocchi.
Ooh.
Have you ever made those?
I haven't. Tell me.
It's mostly ricotta. Actually, this might really fit into your world because it's not no carb, but it is low carb.
Yeah.
It's mostly ricotta, egg, and just like the tiniest bit of flour. And you could probably actually use a coconut flour or something if you wanted to make it flour-free and lower carb. And then you boil them. They're kind of like if you've ever had like a nudie at an Italian restaurant, mm-hmm. which is like the interior of a ravioli without the pasta. They're sort of like that, and they are really just delightful. You can put greens in them, like some minced arugula or minced spinach.
Sounds really good.
That's my favorite homemade gnocchi.
Well, and it's funny you say that. I have had this container of ricotta I've been trying to use up now for weeks. It was one of these things that got purchased when my mother-in-law was sick and then mm-hmm. shoved to the back of the fridge. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't even open it. And it was still fine. I mean, it's grocery store ricotta. It's mm-hmm. not like fancy Claudio's or something. But so I made your famous chicken and ricotta meatballs.
Oh, I love those.
But I still have more.
You still have more? Is it?
It was like a 3-pound tub of ricotta. Wow. I don't know why exactly we purchased it. It was sort of in that fugue state when everything is sort of off in your world.
You buy things
that you later think, why do we have this?
One word of warning though with grocery store ricotta and ricotta and gnocchi is you want the ricotta to be really dry.
Okay.
So it like has a lot of moisture. You probably should drain it overnight before you try to use it to make the gnocchi.
That's a good idea.
But you should. If you have that leftover ricotta, you definitely okay. – it's not that hard. I'm going to find a recipe for you.
Okay. Sounds good. So what do you like to put – so you're making this chicken and fennel ragu for the potato gnocchi mm-hmm. later in this week. What else do you put on it?
I like a red sauce on gnocchi. Mm-hmm. We did a brown butter sauce on the Roman-style gnocchi, which was delicious. Good. I love a gorgonzola cream sauce.
Oh, God. That sounds so
really
good.
Really like a
– yeah, all in.
Yes. Do you have a preferred sauce with gnocchi?
I really – you know, whenever I eat gnocchi, it's been at restaurants. And so I just sort of embrace whatever they're serving. Mm-hmm. I remember years ago, I had like a springtime gnocchi that was brown butter and then ramps Ooh. And I think even spring peas. And it was really, really delicious.
Good stuff. Well, very tasty, not as much trouble as you might think. And no shame in buying the package kind like I did for my dinner later in the week. But here's something else that happened to me at the grocery store this weekend. I learned that my Whole Foods on South Street is no longer grinding meat there at the butcher counter.
Oh, jeez.
This is how I learned it. They typically have ground chicken mm-hmm. out, you know, in the ready to go. But I don't like – I mean ground chicken breast. Yeah. I don't like ground chicken breast. I prefer ground chicken thigh. So I usually call ahead and just ask them to grind up a couple of pounds for me and then pick it up. And they're always happy to do it. But this weekend I learned that they're no longer doing it. And I was really bummed.
Oh, wow.
Because I don't know if how you feel about this, but I don't like meat ground off site. I think it invites foodborne illness. I don't like the idea of, like, you know, hundreds of chicken or cow or whatever, like, being combined in the same package. It just makes me uncomfortable.
I understand that completely.
Do you have a point of view?
I don't buy a lot of ground meat from grocery stores generally. I tend to buy it from local producers just because it makes me feel better. So, like, I buy most of my ground beef or turkey. I buy mostly ground beef and ground turkey from either one of the or buying clubs in Philly or Fair Food Farm Stand.
That's a
or
the idea.
Farmer's Market, because at least I know they're all small scale operations, right. And it also, it's, you know, a couple dollars more, but it supports local producers. And well, so that's typically how I get my ground meat.
Not to go off the rails too much here, but I had another disturbing discovery in meat this past week, which I've definitely talked about this on the show before. I'm a big fan, or was a big fan, of Philly Cowshare.
Uh-oh. Was.
Well, Philly Cowshare doesn't exist anymore.
What?
They apparently, it says on the website that they partnered with this D.C.-based company called From the Farmer, right? And so I didn't look too much into it. I just ordered my, and I it was cool, like, because you could order a la carte. You weren't restricted to just like an eighth of a cow or whatever.
Yeah.
And of course, now they were doing pork before this whole thing happened. But anyway, I didn't really read the fine print, and I didn't realize that the meat was going to be coming from Maryland, which to me is like not all that local, and shipped via FedEx. Which there ended up being like a problem with the FedEx. So my overnight shipment was delayed and like.
Your meat's like languishing somewhere.
Yes. So anyway, it was just like a really. One of the reasons I seek out something like Philly Cowshare is because of what you said about the, you know, a local purveyor. You have a higher degree of confidence in the ground meat. And I did order ground meat in this particular order. And I was just so sad that I lost that as a resource, but we do have buying clubs.
Yeah, the one I like a lot, I get most of my ground beef and beef products in general through it's Meadow Run Farm, and you can order from them through Farm to City.
Mm-hmm.
And they have pickup locations all over the city. And so it's a once-a-month pickup. And so I'll order like ground turkey, ground beef, and sausage because they're making it all sort of in-house, and I trust it more.
And of course, the other alternative when it comes to ground meat that you can feel good about is grinding it yourself.
Yes, which is actually the topic of this segment, but we've digressed. Yeah, so my first introduction to grinding my own meat was those chicken ricotta meatballs that I mentioned earlier that you wrote the recipe for. That has to be like 7 years ago.
A long
now.
Time ago.
They're the best chicken meatballs ever.
I think they're very good.
And
sometimes I say I'm not having a baby, but I did write that recipe. And that's like my legacy to the world.
It is a great recipe. It will forever be part of my personal food canon. There are a few things you've done, Joya, that I'm just like, I wish I had thought of these things. That and your lentil soup with chicken
thighs.
It's
a good meatball.
It is a good meatball. But so I made a batch this last week, and I grind it in the food processor, which is the method you describe in that article.
And if we may just take a minute to talk about that method.
Yes, please.
I think that it's – well, what you basically do is you take your chicken thighs, you cut them into – or at least I usually cut them into like roughly 1-inch pieces.
Yeah.
And then I put them in the freezer to firm up a bit,
maybe
20, 30 minutes. And then you get a much better grind by – doing them in batches in the food processor and pulsing. Is that what you do?
It is. I sometimes don't do it in as many batches as I should. And so it leads to not necessarily, it doesn't get gummy, but it's like a smaller grind.
Right.
And so if you want to preserve sort of a little bit more of the chunkiness, then smaller batches are better. But yeah, that's how I do it. And it works beautifully.
I used to do it that way all the time. But at some point I did upgrade to the KitchenAid meat grinder attachment, which is not expensive. I think its full price is $65, but you can often find it on sale for something like $30. I notice it's on sale right now at Amazon for $32.
Ooh, maybe.
I do think it doesn't take up a lot of space. It works really well, and it's, you know, it's easy.
Yeah.
And you do get better results than any food processor.
Yeah, I mean, the food processor is okay, but it's imperfect. But maybe I'll invest in the grinder.
I think it's far better using the food processor than using that ground chicken or turkey white meat, which I don't think makes as good of a meatball or anything, really. And then also the not knowing, like, where it was ground, under what circumstances, you know, how safe was it?
Yeah, it's funny. It makes me think, if anyone ever read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, there's this whole scene in that book about how the main character is sent out to get ground beef, and she goes to two different butchers because one of the butchers grinds his meat behind closed doors, and she's not allowed to buy that. Her mother doesn't allow her to buy that one because
you want
to
know.
Yeah, you want to know. It's fascinating.
And I mean, there really is no better knowing than just doing it yourself.
Yeah. So Joy has been mentioning her Mother's Day party for her mother and mother-in-law, and the reason we're talking about it is because this segment is all about traveling dinner parties. And so you guys essentially hosted a traveling dinner party.
Right. And we do this a lot. I think the main reason that we did it for Mother's Day was because no one really loves parking in South Philly, especially people that are used to living in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And also it just so happens that Dan's mom and my mom live like only at like a half hour from each other, whereas they both live like an hour from here. Okay. So anyway, it's something that we usually do. Like when it comes to we've took Thanksgiving on the road 1 year, you know, it's like impressive. Being a caterer, you need to pre-plan, have your checklist, do all your prep in advance as much as you can. And so it can be a little bit of a hassle, but it's also really rewarding and fun to go and, you know, just bring dinner to someone.
So talk us through this dinner party you did this week. So it included the gnocchi, I'm assuming.
Okay, look, let me tell you. We were not creative about this. Two weeks ago, we saw a America's Test Kitchen episode where it was like Easy Italian, I think it was called. And they did these semolina gnocchi. And they did a sausage with grapes.
Ooh.
Really good. and so we were like, we're just making both of these recipes. So it was sounds grapes and balsamic and onions, both very good. So we made those two dishes. We made a big salad, and we were going to make dessert, but we sort of like ran out of time and energy. So we ended up picking up cannoli from Termini, which, you know.
Always delicious.
Delicious. But yeah, we could do a lot of things about that in advance. As I mentioned, the gnocchi, you basically make the dough and form them a day ahead. I made it my salad dressing and chopped all my vegetables for the salad, toasted nuts ahead, grated cheese ahead. Mm-hmm. And then we did make the sausage once we got there. We could have prepped that a little bit more ahead, but, you know, it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with the cannoli, you just open the box.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. What about you? Do you take your home cooking on the road?
I have definitely had times where I'm packing up a full meal to share with someone. And so I really like things like a little less fancy, perhaps, but a meatloaf, like a turkey meatloaf, which travels beautifully. I like to do meatloaf with sauteed chard and onions and some herbs. And then you fold that all into the meat mixture. And then I also top it before I bake it with finely sliced onion. Mm-hmm. And so the onions sort of frizzle as the meatloaf cooks.
That's a good idea.
It's really delicious.
I find meatloaf improves. Like if you make it a day ahead, I think the flavors meld more and it slices easier.
Absolutely. It sort of comes together. So it's always better the second day, but sort of a meatloaf, mashed potato and some sort of vegetable, like that trio travels really well. Mm-hmm. You know, meatloaf obviously is going to travel well, but mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
If ever there was a dish that was meant for reheating, mashed potatoes are, you know, they work so well. And so either then some blanched green beans with some almonds or something, and that's a nice little traveling meal. I have in my time taken lots of food on the road, and one of the things that I love the most for anytime you want to bring something that's sort of a bigger dish that you want to be able to reheat is I love my Hamilton Beach Stay or Go slow cooker with a passion. It sounds a little ridiculous. I'm not normally.
Does it have like a lid that clamps on?
It does. That's really important. It has a lid with a plastic or like a rubber seal that clamps on, so that sucker does not leak. It is what I take my brisket in to Passover every year. I have used it at the holidays for like, you know, turkey or mashed potatoes. It is so anytime you need like a large quantity of something that you want to keep warm and be able to sort of reheat on the fly, man, oh man, that slow cooker is the best thing ever. I love it. But also mason jars, obviously. I'm a big fan of packing things in mason jars, as we all know. And you want to, anytime you're traveling with mason jars, you want to get the liquid tight lids versus, you know, the two-piece lids or even the plastic storage caps that Ball makes. They're not liquid tight. And so there are two companies.
I've learned that the hard way.
Oh, they leak like crazy. I mean, because a mason jar is a great thing to take salad dressing in someplace, but you need a lid that is going to
shake it up. Yeah.
And so there are two companies that make lids that I really like. One is Intelligent Lids. Sometimes you see them as eyelids, but they are very liquid tight and they travel beautifully. The other one that's great is the Recap Lids because they have a rubber seal in them so they don't leak. And they're the ones with a little pop top so you can, you don't actually have to take the lid off to pour.
Oh, that's great.
Which is really handy.
Because when you do salad dressing, you don't have the drippage on the
exactly.
lid.
Exactly. And then more recently, I've become a fan of the Pyrex containers that have the locking lids. Have you seen these?
No, I don't even know what they are.
It's like snapware kind of lids. So the lids have a silicone seal in them.
Huh.
And so they seal tight and then the lids sort of snap with little arms into
that's
place.
Great.
And they are amazing. They don't leak. They travel really well. They can fall on their side and they're still not going to leak. Mm. And the nice thing about those silicone seals is that when you take the lid off, they don't make a big mess because conventional Pyrex traveling, like ones with the plastic lids, they'll stay pretty liquid tight. But once you take that lid off, it's often a mess. Mm-hmm. And so the new locking lids are amazing.
Yeah. It is really fun to travel with food.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even cooking at someone else's house is fun too. Like even if you can't make it all ahead.
Exactly.
But I do like to bring my own tools in that case.
Yes.
What are tools that you need to have so much when you're cooking that you'll bring them with you?
I almost always, if I'm going to be doing any sort of prep at someone's house, I'll bring a knife, either, you know, a chef's knife or a paring knife, depending on the situation. I definitely always want to have a big cutting board.
Yeah. Why do people not have big cutting boards?
I don't understand. My mother has like two of the tiniest cutting boards. And then she has one that sort of lives in the corner between the counter and a bureau that's in the kitchen. And so every time I'm at her house, I'm like pulling it off and cleaning it up, you know, cleaning it.
Do you ever go to somebody's house? They have a glass cutting board.
Those are the worst.
The weirdest. What were they thinking?
They're decorative. Just, a note to everyone here. Glass cutting boards aren't actually for cutting on. They are designed to be decorative and they will destroy your blade. And why?
It's a really strange thing to me.
I don't know. What else do you bring along, Joy?
Well, I have, this might be kind of like a weird cooking idiosyncrasy that I have. It's like, I have to have a silicone spoonula. Like usually a couple of them.
Well, and you and I love the same silicone.
Oh, we do?
Yeah, the Mastrad one.
I don't even know. Dan orders them. I don't even know who makes them, but I like almost am helpless to cook without it.
I have like five or six of those. They're the best ones.
Yeah, we love them. And a lot of people don't have those either. I do sometimes buy them for people and they're like, oh.
I know. I made my mother keep one around just for me.
For you, yeah.
Yeah. I also sometimes travel with salt.
That's funny.
Because often you'll find that people just have like terrible iodized table salt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bring salt sometimes.
What drives me crazy about cooking at my sister's house specifically is they don't keep like – I think that – I guess the right word is like a salt cellar where you can like reach in and grab – like feel the salt.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a salt shaker, like –
yeah,
I don't know how much salt I'm adding with a salt shaker. I've really trained myself to like feel the salt. And when I can't season that way, it like cripples me.
I totally understand. Tongs are another one that I sometimes bring with me.
Yeah, we brought those yesterday. I think we did.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
The other thing that I sometimes bring, and my cousins think I'm a little crazy, but I think it's all the training from years of potlucks, is that I always bring serving utensils.
Oh.
Particularly if it's a sort of a communal dinner party, not so much a potluck, but like, you know, a couple people have decided to collaborate. I almost always bring serving utensils just because you don't know if someone's going to have what you need. And it means too that you're not rifling through someone's silverware.
I did
drawer.
A lot of that yesterday.
Yeah.
Rifling through my mother-in-law's stuff. She's lived in that house for 9 years and I've cooked there a lot, but she keeps moving stuff around. It makes me crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I've done over the years too is sort of planted things at my sister's house and my parents' house where, you know, I have worked diligently to improve the quality of knives that live at their respective homes.
Mm-hmm.
all my sister's cookware came from me except for a couple of cast iron pans. Yeah. So I try to like make sure that the things I use are also at the other kitchens I spend the most time at.
I don't know if I've talked about this on this show, but I recently wrote a little book for Quirk Books called Stuff Every Cook Should Know. It's not out yet. It'll be out at the end of the year. But there's a significant portion of that book is dedicated to like what you should buy for your kitchen.
Yeah.
Because I feel like people are so badly informed about that.
It's true.
But we'll maybe we'll transform the toolkit one spoonula at a time. Anyway, so let's go to the store. It's okay. A lovely spring season. We're starting to see more options. And lately, one of my favorites is spring peas.
So good.
I love a spring pea.
Me too. They're so perfect and bright and
sweet.
Sweet. And if you get them in time, they're not at all sort of starchy. They're just little bursts of sweetness.
Easier to shell than favas, for yeah. sure. And I think they taste even better. Although, if Dan were here, he would say that I don't count them as a vegetable, which is true.
Oh, yeah. They're a starch. They're not a vegetable.
They're green. They're like...
But they're not a vegetable.
They are really dirt candy, you know, like... They are the sweetest and easiest to eat of all the vegetables, I think.
Absolutely.
So what do you like to do with them?
So Scott is a huge fan of peas. They are one of his favorite vegetables.
Or non-vegetables.
Or non-vegetables, as the case may be. He really – one of my favorite things to do is to soften a little shallot in butter and then just toss the peas in that for a couple of minutes until they've sort of just warmed through. Mm-hmm. They hardly even need any cooking. You know, put a lid on them so they steam a little bit, right. And then just eat them like that.
Been known to throw them raw into salads.
Oh yeah,
definitely good enough to eat raw. I think that the peas or the peas' best friend is bacon.
Yeah,
that is a good mix. It's the sweet, salty, savory.
It is good,
crispy. It's the best.
I do enjoy too, sort of the classic combination of young spring carrots. And peas.
Peas and carrots.
I know. Yeah, that is so classic. Cliche. And yet there is a reason. Cute. It's really good.
You know what? I can't even remember the last time I had that. It was probably like
from
a can or like in a frozen meal.
You have
something.
To try it again as an adult with like perfect baby carrots and spring peas. Then it's really delicious. I love them tossed with pasta. So like little.
That's another natural fit.
The little shells where they sort of tuck themselves in. Oh like my God. That. It's so good. And that with either some bacon or pancetta and then a little dusting of Parmesan cheese.
Simple and delicious.
A little salad on the side and you're good.
Yeah. I do like to – I think we talked about this last week when we talked about stuff on toast, but I do like them mashed on toast too.
Yes, absolutely.
And speaking of your surplus ricotta, peas are very good with ricotta, I think, either with pasta or on toast.
Ooh, I want ricotta and peas on toast.
Or maybe you'll make the ricotta gnocchi and then make like a pancetta pea
situation
for the top.
That sounds so good.
Yeah, I think it would be. If you make that, you need to Instagram it for me.
I will. God, that sounds delicious. I also love a spring pea soup. Little mint.
Oh, so much.
Yeah.
Though, if I make that in the spring, I often find myself squirreling it away in the freezer until it gets to be the winter. Yeah. Pea soup is one of my favorites.
Oh, my God. It's so good.
Simple. It's so simple.
Yeah.
And you honestly can make it with the frozen peas, and it's almost as good.
It's true. If you get the like itty bitty baby frozen peas, they're pretty good.
That's nice stuff.
It is. I talked about this last week with the favas last week. I do sometimes like to marinate them. So a little bit of vinegar and olive oil and herbs, and they turn into this, you know, very bright, sweet, crunchy, little quick pickle.
Oh, that's really great. Nice. Yeah. Well, I think that about does it for our show today. Our thanks to Dan Call for editing our show and to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo. Thanks to Raina Rose for providing our music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.